I don't know, maybe we should have had more Kafka-esque music to open the show, but I'm not even sure what that would be. We're going to talk about Franz Kafka today, but I wanted to say that you shouldn't be intimidated by that if you don't have a deep familiarity with his work. Everybody feels like they know something about Kafka, right? People just sling the name around all the time anyway. But you shouldn't be intimidated. We're going to explain lots of things to you that will help you understand who he was. In our second and third segments, we'll talk first to an artist who has created a graphic novel based on 14 of Kafka's stories. That one is actually called Kafka-esque. I guess it's not a graphic novel. It's a graphic collection of stories. And towards the end, we'll really kind of explore that adjective, Kafka-esque, and whether it's appropriately applied or not. But right now, we want to begin with a story that actually stretches right up almost to the doorstep of the present. Perhaps ironically, Kafka's work became the subject of all things, a trial. And we need to explain to you the nature of that trial. But to do that, we're going to have to lay some groundwork here. The trial itself is a pretty Kafka-esque thing. Joining us right now is Benjamin Ballant, library fellow at the Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem. He's the author of, most recently, Kafka's Last Trial, The Case of a Literary Legacy. His next book, co-authored with Mirav Mack, is Jerusalem, City of the Book. That's due out in May. He's joining us by Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So I think before we get to the trial, we have to just sort of sketch out a little bit about these. We have to take a little trip into the past and sketch out these two figures. One of them is the well-known name, Franz Kafka. The other one, though, is the other half of this really unusual Prague bromance, and his name is Max Brod. So tell us, first of all, a little bit about the friendship between these two men.
In a way, it was a friendship between opposites. I mean, in a sense, Kafka, as sort of inward-looking as he was, met his match in Max Brod. They met in university. Max Brod was outgoing. He was responsible for essentially promoting Kafka during his lifetime, championing him. The first ever book review ever written about Kafka was by Max Brod himself. Very outgoing personality who was also a much more acclaimed author in his day than Kafka ever was. Max Brod ended up publishing something like 80 books. He had the opposite problem of Kafka. Kafka sort of was a perfectionist, and Max Brod was, if he erred at all, it was on the side of being very prolific.
Right. I think you described one of his 650-page books as brambly. yeah, there's this incredible contrast that Kafka has published almost nothing. I think a total of maybe 450 pages, something like that, by the time that he dies. But Brod has published a lot of work, and he's this huge Kafka enthusiast. He's not only Kafka's best buddy, but he's a big believer in a writer that essentially nobody else knows about. So that brings us to Kafka's rather unusual request at the time of his death.
So basically, Max Brod returns from the funeral. From Kafka died of tuberculosis just short of his 41st birthday. Max Brod returns from the funeral in Prague and goes to Kafka's apartment and finds there thousands of pages of unfinished novels and stories and diaries and notebooks. And among the rest of this mess, he also finds two notes addressed to him. And both say essentially the same thing. They say, "Dear Max, it's my last dying wish that you burn all of my manuscripts unread." And this is sort of the defining moment of Max Brod's life. He had to choose between his loyalty to his closest friend and his loyalty to literary posterity.
Right. And this is across the decades something that's really been debated. I find myself, I want to know what you think, but I find myself most persuaded by the idea that, you know, Kafka already knew that Brod had said many times, your work needs to be read more. You should, you know, everybody needs to see this stuff. You're a great writer. You're terrific. So it seems like an odd choice to have decided to entrust to a man who'd already declared allegiance to the exact opposite outcome, an odd choice by Kafka to say, oh, you know, you're the guy who's going to burn all my stuff.
I sort of read this as one element of Kafka's brilliance, that he chose the man least likely to carry out his last wishes. And I think he probably had some premonition of what Brod would do, which was precisely the opposite of Kafka's request. And that is, Broad not only saved the this great treasure trove, really, but dedicated the rest of his life to editing it, publishing it, making himself into the greatest posthumous editor of the 20th century, giving us the Kafka that we have today. This is all really our debt to Broad. Zadie Smith has a nice phrase. She says, to this day, we have no choice but to read Kafka broadly. That is, through Broad's eyes, through his editing. And this was the great project of Max Broad's life.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in just a second, but let's stay with the biographical part for just a second. So there are many differences between these two men. It may have been the key to their bromance. But one of them is that although, you know, our image of Kafka is of this rather gaunt, kind of handsome looking guy, and Broad really wasn't very much either one of those things. Kafka was a little bit unlucky in love or ambivalent about women, his relationships with women, whereas Broad was, as they say, reliable with the ladies, right? He was kind of a ladies' man.
Yes, very much so. And that's one of the ways that Broad really tried to draw Kafka out of himself. Kafka confided in Broad all of his, let's say, rocky relationships with women. He was twice engaged to the same woman. He never married, unlike Max Broad, who did. And there's another sense in which Broad tried to, let's say, sway Kafka, and that is that Max Broad was, and this will become relevant later in our story, but Max Broad was sort of front and center of the Zionist circles of Prague, especially in the 19-teens and 1920s, and was always trying to sort of recruit Kafka to the cause. Of course, Kafka refused to be drawn out, refused to belong. And in my interpretation, there's some link between these two, let's say, reluctances. That is, Kafka, you might say, had a problem with or an ethic of non-arrival. In other words, he never saw himself as arriving, neither in the sense of domestic, you know, harmony, nor in the sense of arriving to the promised land, which is something that Max Broad ultimately did.
Right. So Max Broad arrives in several different ways. And I mean, the reason that I bring up the ladies is not out of sheer prurience, although I'm not above that, but because it's significant, because one of the relationships, perhaps, I guess maybe the last significant relationship that Max Broad has is with a woman who is his secretary, who is married to apparently a very accommodating man. So tell us about Esther.
Well, to go back one step, I mean, the Max Broad had to rescue these manuscripts not just from Kafka himself, but then several years later from the Nazi occupation of Prague. And Max Broad, before he meets Esther, he rescues these papers in a single suitcase on the last train that was permitted to leave to cross the Czech-Polish border. And ultimately, although he tried to come to the United States several times, ultimately the only place that would accept him was then British Mandatory Palestine, where Max Broad arrives in 1939. And then he meets this lifelong, very close friend, intimate friend, and secretary, Esther Hoffe, who essentially helps him in this lifelong work of publishing the rest of Kafka's masterpieces.
Right. And so and before we get even to that, I think maybe it is time to say one more thing, the thing that you were kind of getting at, I think, about Max Broad, which is that, you know, a few of these manuscripts get published pretty quickly, but the world doesn't fall down on its knees before Franz Kafka at that point. There really needs to be a Kafkaology invented. If he's going to be the St. Paul to Kafka's Jesus, I guess that's a pretty tortured comparison, but I mean, he has to invent some, it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, some of the mytha of Kafka, some of the, I don't know, the legend, he has to make him a little bit more of an idol or an icon.
Absolutely. Max Broad is the myth maker of Kafka. In fact, he was the first biographer of Kafka. He published a biography of Kafka as early as 1937, which sort of set the tone for everyone else. So he has his hand not just in publishing Kafka, but as you say quite rightly, in making the Kafka legend as it is. And you know, he was criticized for that. He was criticized for removing certain material from Kafka's diaries. I mean, after all, I should say, too, that he made an ethical choice not just to publish the fiction that Kafka left unfinished, but also to publish all of Kafka's more personal and intimate material. So the reason we have Kafka's diaries today, the reason we have Kafka's letter to his father, his correspondence, much of his correspondence, his love letters, this is all the work also of Max Brod.
And I mean, up to and including kind of editing and finishing certain things.
Sure.
Eventually, Brod dies, and it turns out that this woman, Esther Hoffa, is now in possession of, I don't know, how much of the stuff that we're talking about does Esther wind up with?
Yeah, well, I should say that Kafka and Max Brod had one thing in common, which is that both were childless. So Max Brod is now in Tel Aviv. He's working with Esther Hoffe, and he, in the 1960s, writes a will. In this will, which becomes the centerpiece of the Litter trial, he says two things. He says, on the one hand, I give you, Esther Hoffe, everything, all of my estate, including all of my Kafka manuscripts, worth untold millions, in part because he couldn't pay her. He didn't have a lot of money, and he couldn't pay her for all her years of work for him. And on the other hand, he says something else, which is that I wish that before you, Esther Hoffe, before you die, that you arrange for the deposit of all of this in a proper archive, such as, and he lists a few, the first one in his list is the National Library in Jerusalem. So when Max Brod dies in 1968, Esther Hoffe, who had never met Kafka, inherits everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everything is a lot. This eventually will get us kind of one generation later to the trial. But before that happens, she actually does, because I guess she doesn't really have a lot of money. Max Brod didn't pay her a lot of money. She auctions off a thing or two, right?
Right. So you have to imagine that these manuscripts now are in an apartment on Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv that is shared. Esther shares it with her daughter, Eva, who will come into our story later, with thousands of pages of Kafka's manuscripts and about a dozen cats. Mm-hmm. It's a very unlikely setting. And as you say, after Max Brod died in 1968, she did something that she never dared to do during his lifetime, and that is she starts to sell things off piecemeal. So the most prominent example is that in 1988, she goes to Sotheby's in London, and she puts up the Kafka's original manuscript of his novel, The Trial, for auction. And it becomes the highest selling modern manuscript ever sold. It went for about $2 million.
And it goes to where?
Well, that's exactly the thing. She was roundly criticized at the time because scholars said, well, look, I mean, it could be that if you put something up for auction, anyone can buy it. This manuscript, which is priceless, could end up in some, you know, private safe somewhere and never to be seen again. In the event, it was bought by the world-class literature archive of Germany in a town called Marbach, Germany. And they added it to their collection of Kafka manuscripts. It was sort of their crown jewel. And they ultimately were the purchasers of that manuscript. And ever since, they've really been, the Marbach Archive has really been interested in adding to its Kafka collection.
Right. And so a lot of the rest of the story is this protracted conversation about to whom does Franz Kafka belong? To whom does his work belong? Where does it belong? And in Germany, although obviously in lots of ways, Germany seems like a betrayal and an inappropriate place for the work of a Jewish writer to land. On the other hand, Germany has a long obsession with Kafka, probably a greater obsession than is shared by the rest of the world, right?
Exactly. And the first and most obvious reason for that is that Kafka wrote in German, and he wrote in a very precise and pure German. Kafka didn't consider himself German. I mean, after all, he was living in Prague. I write in the book that he was sort of, I see him as a sort of triple minority or triply displaced in the sense that the Czechoslovakia was at the time a minority within the greater Austro-Hungarian Empire. The German speakers of Czechoslovakia were a minority within that country, and the Jews were a triple minority within the minority within the minority. So this is another sense in which this issue of belonging comes to the fore, and Kafka's refusal of belonging. But purely for the linguistic sense, because he wrote in German, for Marbach and for the Germans, he belongs firmly in the canon of German modernist literature.
Right. And you go around Germany and there's a Kafka Strasse in a lot of towns, right? They name streets after him and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
So, you know, maybe you can make an argument for them for it to be in the National Museum in Israel. Maybe you can make an argument for this archival center in Germany. I think everybody would agree that this work needs to be where people can look at it, scholars can study it. And that, for a long, long time, is exactly not where it is. I mean, except for these things that are sold off piecemeal. So where does the bulk of the work stay?
The bulk of the work is split into three. It's in this apartment on Spinoza Street that belongs to the Hoffe family. It's in the bank vaults in Switzerland, in Zurich, where Max Brod deposited it before he gave it in his will to Esther Hoffe. And it's in a bank vault in Tel Aviv. So it's sort of spread out. And as you say, it's completely inaccessible to researchers and to scholars for all those decades from the death of Max Brod in 1968 until basically the present.
So eventually this story does devolve from Esther down to her, initially to her two daughters, Ruth and Eva. So what were their attitudes towards this inheritance?
Well, Esther Hoffe died at the age of 100 in 2007 without fulfilling that second condition of Max Brod's will, without depositing it into any archive. She kept all these things in the locations that I just mentioned. And just at the very last moment, the State of Israel, acting through the National Library, which sort of functions here the way the Library of Congress does in the U.S., stepped in at the last moment and filed an objection to the probate of her will and said basically to the daughters, Eva and Ruth, the ones you just mentioned, no, 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 this is not your property. You don't have the right to inherit this. This belongs to the State of Israel, to the National Library in Jerusalem, as significant cultural heritage belonging to the Jewish people. At that point is really when the trial began, the trial that culminated in 2016 in the Israeli Supreme Court. And that trial really had these three points of the triangle of contesting interests. On the one hand, you had the National Library of Israel, which said Kafka's material belongs to us. It's a national property, cultural heritage, shouldn't belong in the hands of an individual, not least an individual who has kept it under lock and key. You had the private interest represented by Eva Hoffe, who saw this as a family affair. Max Brod was really a father figure to her and her sister, who helped to raise them, and who simply wanted to inherit her mother's estate. And then lastly, the German Literary Archive in Marbach, sort of the equivalent of the National Library in Jerusalem, stepped in to weigh in on the side of Eva Hoffe and to say, listen, you and your mother have been negotiating to sell all the rest of this to us. We are going to weigh in on your side to say, first, you have the right to sell this material to whomever you choose. And second, we're going to counter the Israeli claim and say, no, actually, Kafka belongs more properly to German culture than to the culture of a state that didn't exist when he died.
Right. So, and there's so much here, but we should say that at a certain point, one of the sisters dies, Ruth dies, and I think her lawyer at the time said that the protracted, drawn-out stress of the trial probably contributed to her death. And so now it's down to Eva. And I don't know, is there a little bit you can sketch out for us about Eva? She seems like a Kafka character, or maybe a Max Brod character.
Yeah, you know, I mean, she was portrayed in the press when the press on this trial became international as a sort of greedy, eccentric cat lady. And I spent many hours with her, and I found her quite the opposite. I found her to be quite a sympathetic character. She saw herself almost as a character in a Kafka novel, in the sense that she was an individual who saw herself as facing these two Goliaths, in the sense of these two state actors, right? And she felt at times quite helpless, quite despairing. And as I say, she really at one point she even told me, she said to me, you know, Kafka has been like a curse to me. And I said, why is that? And she said, it's because all the Kafka material has been mixed up with all the Max Brod estate that has generated all this interest and all these claims on behalf of Germany and Israel. And she said, I would willingly part with the Kafka manuscripts, as valuable as they are in monetary terms, if I were simply allowed to inherit Max Brod's estate and to promote Max Brod's memory.
Well, and there was also, I think she was not living a wealthy person's life by any means, and there was other money that she was eligible to inherit, but that was all backed up or tied up until the Kafka stuff could be resolved. She was going to be in penury. If she just let go of all the Kafka stuff, she would have come into, I think, some pretty significant money. But, you know, that's, you know, in many of Kafka's characters, they are victims of, yes, these Leviathan organizations, but often they contribute to it somehow, too. Often they are at least partly the authors of their own problems. And is there a sense in which she's a Kafka character that way, that rather than working out some kind of compromise, she sort of, you know, stayed the course on this vision that she had?
Yeah, certainly. And I think none of the three sides is blameless in that sense. I mean, each acted, I think, in a quite heavy-handed way. As I say, both she and her mother could have acted quite differently. They could have opened the archives to researchers and to scholars. I mean, some of this stuff, I spoke to Kafka biographers in Germany who are just dying to see some of this stuff for the light that it would shed. For example, it has not just Kafka's diaries, but Max Brod's diaries that would shed light on their long and complex relationship. So, yeah, I mean, each of the sides could have behaved, I think, in a bit more of a flexible way. But then, you know, then you wouldn't have had this sort of comic, tragic adventure story that Kafka himself could have almost authored himself, you know.
And we should say that, you know, each of these sides, they have agendas. So Germany is looking to refurbish its reputation. It's done healthy, I think, self-examination about the past, but it doesn't want to be a country where a Jewish writer can't be honored. It wants to be a country where a great Jewish writer who wrote in German can be honored. Israel, and I think Max Brod probably would have thought so too, Israel sees this as an opportunity to showcase a great, great, significant Jewish writer and whose best friend, you know, brought this work to the future site of Israel. And so, I mean, everybody's got kind of an agenda. Does anybody have the agenda of what you just described, like let the scholars, the biographers, everybody should just be able to read this stuff. Let's not worry too much about where it goes.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the strange thing about the trial is that, first of all, a lot of the material, the manuscripts, had already been published, right? So we have the trial, we have the original manuscript sitting in this apartment, right? But of course, the trial itself has already been published. So and both Marbach and the National Library in Jerusalem had pledged to digitize the material should they get it. So the question is really one of why, of the aura, let's say, of that persists even in this age of the digital, the aura of the original manuscript. Why are people willing to spend millions on a Kafka manuscript, or tens of thousands on a single Kafka postcard? Why are they willing? Why are two states willing to invest so many years of in this legal battle, if it weren't not just for the matter of national prestige, but if it weren't for the aura somehow that still persists, that a manuscript, an original manuscript, still has, even if that manuscript, you know, can't really add to our knowledge of a novel like The Trial, which has been endlessly pored over.
Right. And I think, you know, the other, I don't know if it's an irony or not, but I mean, you know, we talked about what Max Brod had done to invent Kafkaology. He invented what ultimately became this incredible, you couldn't even call it a cottage industry. It's too big to fit in a cottage. I mean, the scholarship of Kafka is, you know, exists in orders of magnitude greater than Kafka's extant work. But it's also coffee mugs and tote bags and gift shops. And I mean, except for Edvard Munch, I can't think of anybody else who's early 20th century anxiety has been so completely monetized and turned into merchandise, right?
Even Andy Warhol did a portrait of Kafka.
Right. So I don't know. We should say how this all got resolved. Ultimately, how did the trial end?
Well, so I should say that I was sitting in the Supreme Court in the summer of 2016 listening to this, and I was, before I get to the spoiler, actually, and I was astonished at how the trial really moved on two registers or two levels of language, right? So on the one hand, there's an interpretation of Max Brod's will, and it's a legalistic argument. On the other hand, just boiling beneath the surface were these heavily ideological claims. So I'm sitting there in the Supreme Court, and I hear, you know, that the Israeli lawyers are saying things like, well, Germany is the last place that Kafka's legacy should be. All three of Kafka's beloved sisters were killed in the Holocaust. You can't say that you Germans are particularly good custodians of Kafka's legacy. And on the other hand, you had the German lawyers say to the Israeli side, well, look, you know, Kafka was not a Zionist. He never stepped foot in this country. What's his connection, right, to the modern state of Israel? So before we get to the actual verdict, the significance of the verdict was not just who owns the material manuscripts, but not just even what kind of a writer Kafka is, but also who has the right to claim, let's say, a Jewish writer living in the diaspora. In other words, I had the sense, even sitting there that day in the trial, that each of these countries was attempting to nationalize this writer who refused in his lifetime to be claimed by either. In other words, you know, the trial really shed light on Germany's claim on a writer whose family was decimated by the Holocaust, and its own, by the way, its own sort of post-war attempt to overcome its shameful past. But it also reawakened this debate here in Israel about the ambivalence of Kafka towards the Jewish state, and in turn, Israel's ambivalence towards Kafka and towards German language culture, right? In the end, and that's just a long and windy maybe way of getting back to your question, in the end, the Supreme Court of Israel decided in favor of the National Library that in the end, Eva Hoffa had to give everything up without any recompense whatsoever. Afterwards, I spoke to her, and she was, of course, despairing and devastated, and she had lost everything. And as we speak, these manuscripts, it's still very very much a current story because these manuscripts are still making their way to the National Library.
So there's so many, many, many other details to be consumed. And this is just fascinating storytelling, Benjamin Balance, Kafka's Last Trial, The Case of a Literary Legacy. I think I agree ultimately, and the way that you put it helps me even think this way, that, you know, that it's a mistake to locate Kafka anywhere. His stories have become so universal. I think there's somebody towards the end of your book who says they should just shoot it up to the moon or Mars or someplace like that and, you know, let it be away from anywhere because...
Well, I had this fear. Yeah, one person suggested, yeah, it should be sort of out of this earth, right?
Yeah.
So that nobody can make a claim. But I had this great fear, and not only me, but also Eva Hoffa's friends towards the end of her life. By the way, she died in August in the shadow of this loss. But several of us had the fear that she would take drastic action, having lost the verdict at the Supreme Court, that she would somehow set fire to the manuscripts in her apartment, thereby, first of all, making a declaration that if I can't have it, no one will. And then in a funny kind of way, you know, closing the circle and fulfilling Kafka's will from 1924. Fortunately, she did not do that.
All right. So for more, you got to read the book, Kafka's Last Trial, The Case of a Literary Legacy by Benjamin Balint. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
This is all fascinating stuff. All right, let's meet some new Kafka friends after this break, and maybe even some friends here from WNPR will be appearing in Kafka-esque guise.
Came to his desk, prior to Kafka, where towns and minds are Romanesque. Hey, Kafka, his self-esteem is statuesque. Ooh.
All All right, we're back with more Kafka. Now joining us is Peter Cooper, a freelance illustrator who has written and illustrated Mad Magazine's Spy vs. Spy. Isn't Jonathan McNichol a huge Spy vs. Spy fan? I think he is, yeah, since 1997. Not that I'm not. I read it as a kid. He's produced many books and adapted Kafka's The Metamorphosis into comics. His most recent graphic novel is Kafka-esque. This is 14 Kafka stories that are rendered in comic style. And Peter Cooper is joining us right now. Hi.
Hey, how you doing, Colin?
Good. So, you know, when I read these stories the way that you've done them and look at the art that you've done, it just seems like such an incredibly natural fit to have the right kind of graphic artist take this material. But how did you know that could work? Or what made you want to do it?
When I first came upon Kafka, I was The Metamorphosis, and I thought of him as just being very dark and I didn't see any humor in it. And a friend of mine who was a big fan of Kafka would read him aloud over beers, and listening to it and finding myself laughing, not just because of the beers, it struck me that comics would be a really great his writing in comics would work rather perfectly. And back in 1988, I tried the first one, which was a fratricide, which is included in this collection. And it just fell into place very quickly. And subsequently, whenever I had the opportunity to do a short story, I would pull out a Kafka and try it. And they suggested ideas for storytelling that I didn't have myself for my own writing. And it gave me this sort of freedom to play around with the storytelling and have his text act as an anchor.
And I think, you know, I was so glad to read in the introduction that you were influenced by some of the early newspaper comics. Newspaper comics used to be so great, so weird and dreamlike, and the art was so inspired. Winsor McCay, who created Dream of the Rare Bit Fiend, and I think, didn't McCay create Little Nemo, too?
Yeah, that was more kid-friendly version. Dream of the Rare Bit Fiend, which is, I think he started in like 1903 or 4, which, you know, is a contemporary of Kafka's. And I always wondered whether Kafka might have seen newspapers from the United States, and that was in any way, I don't know if it would be an influence, but even just that he found the kinship that came from the zeitgeist of that time period.
So we've taken a few of the stories that you've adapted and had some of our people voice them. So I'm going to play one of them and have you react to it. This is literally a cat and mouse story called A Little Fable.
A Little Fable. Alas, every passing day, the world becomes narrower, said the mouse. At first it was so wide that I was frightened and kept running and running. I was relieved when at last I saw walls in the distance to the right and left. But these long walls have narrowed so quickly that I am already in the last room, and there stands the trap that I must run into. You only have to change your direction, said the cat, and ate him up.
All right, that's read by Lydia Brown. I'm Lydia Brown's manager. You want her to read stuff, you have to go through me. Peter, help us out a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about the story and how you handled it.
Well, that sounds like the Democrats' response to Trump's address last night.
Well, there's walls.
There's walls, and there's the, you know, a hungry cat waiting and saying all you have to do is, you know, turn around, basically. I looked at these. I had a short story collection, and it was the ones that were translated in the 50s and 40s and 50s. And there's this wonderful stilted quality to that tone also. I just love the voice that you get from those, which I discovered in the process of retranslating and reading a lot of other translations, is not, you know, strictly, like all translations, they go through a process and each translator comes up with a slightly different answer. So the voice of Kafka, we are really hearing, unless you know German, you're really hearing it through somebody else's voice. I prefer the one from the 50s to more modern translations. And I tried to hew to that general tone. But stories like that, when I read them, they inspired a lot of references to current events, but at the same time, that kind of eternal quality. And I'm certainly seeing lots and lots of of associations between Kafka and what's going on in the world today and in the United States, and maybe in particular, but that's my, you know, being here and all, and it's going on around the world, that these bureaucracies and these circumstances where the world is getting smaller, and that I could show that in this form, that with, you know, having it be anthropomorphic, where there's animals doing it, also has a universality to it, which I love when Kafka does use animals.
Right. I have this whole theory that Paul Manafort would be a great Kafka story. But yeah, there's a way in which, you know, here's this guy who really for most of his life didn't venture far out of Prague, only occasionally, you know. I mean, spent most of his life in one location, wrote in German, and this stuff, it just makes sense to a magical realist in Argentina or Brazil. It would make sense, I think, almost anywhere in the world. There's a real transferability of all this stuff. And I think the way that you've handled it, too, calls a lot of attention to this. Let's hear just a little tiny segment. This is voiced by Katie Tularsky. From The Trees.
The Trees. For we are like tree trunks in the snow. They appear to rest lightly, and a little prod should get them rolling. No, it can't be done, for they are firmly attached to the ground. But look, that too is only appearance.
You explain what it was that you did with The Trees. The Trees called you to another contemporary problem.
Living in New York City, the constant issue of homelessness, it's always in our face, just every walk to and fro. And when I read that very short, like one paragraph story, what I saw was homelessness, and that it was, and it was another way, I was really deeply enjoying a sense of having Kafka kind of whisper in my ear. I know that was just my own doing, but it felt like these things were suggested. Like I wasn't trying to overlay a checklist of social woes. I just simply read the story, and that's what popped into my head. And that I think I could probably read any number of these stories, and anybody who picks up Kafka and reads them will find their own interpretations. And that's really the beauty of Kafka, is how much anybody who reads him will come away from it with a different vision.
I like that idea of Kafka whispering in your ear, because I think that kind of has to happen, right? You have to do a Vulcan mind melt of some kind if you're going to do this.
Indeed. And he's probably flying around the universe at this very moment, so.
All right.
Laughing at all of this, so.
So let's talk about one more. Let's talk about In the Penal Colony. I mean, I don't know. I could just say that name and already people are going to start thinking about, I mean, we're doing this particular show on the Wednesday after President Trump's wall speech. You don't have to stretch very far, I think, to make this connection. Let's hear the voices of Lily Tyson, the producer for Next, and Jonathan McPants, producer of our show.
It was early morning and the streets were clean and empty as I headed to the train station. When I compared the church clock with my watch, I discovered it was much later than I thought, and I needed to hurry. The shock of this discovery caused me to doubt my way. I didn't really have a feel for the city just yet. Fortunately, I spotted a nearby policeman. I ran up to him and breathlessly asked for directions.
You want directions? From me?
Yes, since I don't know the way myself.
Give it up. Give it up.
He said, then turned away, like a man who wants to be alone with his laughter.
So that's from Give It Up. But I mean, there are a bunch of stories, several of the stories that involve people interacting with very large, imposing, not particularly friendly looking authority figures, Peter Cooper.
Yes. Yeah. That Give It Up was one that particularly spoke to the anxiety that I was feeling at the time, and that it also fell out as the drawing of that story, where I was doing storytelling that I just hadn't thought about before, and the text just inspired it so completely, and it was part of this kinship I found with his writing and with a number of writers, that they just, the way they speak to you kind of adds another layer to your own knowledge, and in this case through my drawings, I found all sorts of storytelling modes that I could go kind of crazy with it. And I do have an enthusiasm for comics that is Kafkaesque, and that I am constantly trying to share this with people. And having done this for many years, it was especially through the years where people didn't think that graphic novels had a place in bookstores or libraries. And so I felt like I was always trying to demonstrate what could be done with a comic strip. And Kafka was a beautiful way to combine the literary world and the comics world that could show somebody who thought that they weren't neither fans of comics nor thought that they could, you know, read a comic and, you know, in an unusual way and follow it. And I'd like to think that I managed to do both of those things.
I think you certainly did. And we have to stop now because we've got one more segment to go here. But great talking to you, Peter Cooper, creator of Kafkaesque 14 Stories, a graphic novelized collection of Kafka. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back with one more conversation.
An insect, so Kafkaesque. I once heard it said.
All right, I've got my Kafka tote bag, and I've got my Kafka Instant Pot cookbook, my Kafka foam, big foam finger, my Kafka beer koozie. I think I'm ready to start listening to one of his albums. No album? I didn't understand. All right, today's, I wrote that joke for Kion Wolf, but then I forgot to give it to her. So today's show is produced by Betsy Kay and by Kion Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Anthony Perkins. And tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about changes in the English language. Also about the year in swearing in 2018. I guess who swore most notably. All right, so finally here on the show, you know, this, as we got ready to do this show, we just kept talking about the fact that people just sling that word around all the time, Kafkaesque. And so what does it actually mean? Well, joining us, I hope I'm about to say her name correctly, Charlotte Allen. Am I saying your name right? Is that how you say it?
Charlotte Aline.
Aline, okay.
That's a hard one to pronounce.
Oh, no, I think I can manage it. Charlotte Aline, writer, playwright, actor, and artist. She wrote, "The meaning of Kafkaesque is about more than just pointless bureaucracy and giant insects for bustle." Well, the title kind of says it all, but do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of people use the word Kafkaesque as a synonym for frustrating or bureaucratic. And on a certain level, I mean, you're not wrong if you're filling out some convoluted paperwork and you think this is a Kafkaesque process to be stuck in, or if you're uploading your resume to one of those websites that then makes you type out all of your work experience all over again once you've uploaded the PDF. That's always annoying to me. But I think a lot of people miss some of the nuances of the phrase, that in Kafka's writing, it's not just that people are frustrated with bureaucracy, it's that they're using their own circular logic to fight circular logic. Like when Gregor Samsa wakes up as a giant cockroach, his first thought isn't like, "Oh gosh, what does this mean? Why have I turned into a giant cockroach?" His first thought is, "Oh, I'm going to have to get to work on time. I'm going to be late for work." He's still thinking within this system. He's still acting like a cog in the machine.
I think it's a really great point, and it's kind of typical of us, too, that we use Kafkaesque to talk about them, what they are doing to us, mm-hmm. those people, they. And really, in a lot of Kafka, it's not that we make our own hells, but we contribute somehow, that it would be impossible to so fully imprison us if we didn't do some of the jailing ourselves.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite of his short stories, Poseidon, where he's talking about the sea god Poseidon is unable to explore his own oceans or appreciate any of the wonder of the sea because he's stuck at his desk doing paperwork. But the reason he gives for being stuck at his desk doing paperwork is that he doesn't trust anyone else with the work. He thinks everyone else is beneath him. So I think that's kind of unusual in a Kafka story, that the protagonist is also the person in power and not sort of the soul-crushed businessman who's working for someone. But like even the boss himself hates that he's stuck at his desk and yet won't let up on the work he's assigning himself. There's so much of people trapping themselves in these systems in writing.
It's totally the case of Poseidon. He has built his own prison and he won't deal with it. So that, but you know, go back to what you initially said, though. You know, we throw the word around to describe situations we're in. I do feel as though there are situations today. I feel like if Kafka were alive today, he'd be very interested in social media. And in particular, I think he might be interested in those terms of use things that we click accept to, right? I don't know. Do you have thoughts about these things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's wrong to use the word Kafkaesque to describe just any situation that reminds you of the sort of absurd bureaucracy of Kafka. But yeah, certainly like the iTunes agreement or any of these things where they make you scroll to the bottom to be able to click OK, but no one has ever read it. And there could be almost any kind of information in there. I think a lot of our social media use, especially whenever I see people on social media complaining about the evils of social media, it just feels very like we're all trapped in a Franz Kafka novel. It feels very circular. Like we hate this system that forces us to, you know, feel judged by other people's photos and feel constantly outraged by the 24 news cycle. And yet the only way we have of registering our frustration is to post a status about how upset we are.
Right. And also there's this Mephistophelian bargain that we never acknowledge. I mean, you know, Facebook is this tremendous tool which is given to us, quote, for free, unquote.
Yeah.
And it's really not. And if we thought about it for 10 seconds, we would realize that nobody's going to build something that's that pervasive and that good and that all-encompassing and that useful in terms of making connections and archiving your life and communicating with other people. Nobody's going to hand you that for nothing.
No.
Yeah, so go ahead. Riff on that if you want.
Oh, yeah. I think certainly any kind of, and what's scary is how often I in my daily life, if I see something pop up that says like, we've updated our privacy agreement, I always just click okay. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that. And I'm someone who will like rant to my friends about like how I'm worried that social media is like stealing all our information and selling it to advertisers. And that's just not right. But like, absolutely, I would never take that far enough to then actually read any of the agreements that I'm just saying yes to. I could be like Joseph K. They could come to my door any day now and say that I've sold my soul in a Facebook agreement, and I wouldn't have a leg to stand on defending myself, because who knows? Maybe I did.
Right. So, if Franz Kafka were alive today, definitely he would write something called the privacy agreement. So I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you about, Charlotte Arlene, is, you know, the other thing about Kafka, he died at the age of 41. He was a very obscure person at that time. We don't have the chance to ask him questions about, well, how much of this was intended to be comic, how much of this was intended to be tragic and alienating. And maybe that's one of the reasons we struggle a little bit with the overall meaning of his legacy.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how funny his writing is. I feel this way about a lot of writers that most of us encounter for the first time in high school. We're almost afraid of the comedy of it because we're taught that, like, you know, serious writing is tragic primarily, or dramatic, that comedy isn't as serious. But I think his work is funny on a personal level. A lot of it is funny in that the situation is so absurd, but also funny in that we're watching these characters sort of play into their own suffering to continue to try to find ways within the system to free themselves from the system. And it's just never going to work. Like in the trial, no matter who he appeals to, all the people with more power, still no one seems to know who's in charge or who's making these rules. Everyone just follows them. I think you have to recognize some level of absurdity in there. Although, of course, there's no telling what Kafka himself would have wanted us to take away from his stories.
Right. I think if you don't think there's something funny about being turned into a giant cockroach, you're probably not trying hard enough. Charlotte Arlene, writer, playwright, actor, artist. She wrote The Meaning of Kafkaesque. It's about more than just pointless bureaucracy and giant insects for bustle. Thanks for being with us, Charlotte.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back tomorrow with a show about the English language, assuming that today is today and tomorrow is tomorrow. which, given the fact that you might be listening on a podcast 3 years from now and we have robot overlords, is guesswork on my part.